My second lecture, I would like to talk a bit about leptonic and semi-leptonic exclusive decays. And so in the beginning, I would like to talk about the leptonic ones, then go to the semi-leptonic ones. And in the semi-leptonic ones, the hadronic form matrix elements are form factors. And so I will show you some methods how to determine these form factors. And now the main motivation here is also to extract VCB and VUB in these observables. And what you see frequently in the literature nowadays is something called Z expansions for these form factors. And further, there are unitarity bounds that can be derived, and they are most conveniently formulated in these Z expansions. So I would like to talk a bit about that. And then in the end, I would like to talk about heavy-to-heavy form factors in HQET and the symmetry relations that exist there, because they also very frequently exploited nowadays when it comes to the determination of VCB from B to D or B to D star decays. So, as I said, the motivation is really to determine VCB and VUB from either leptonic decay, so there we have a B sub U meson and it just annihilates and there's a lepton in antineutrino. And this is given by a single observable, the branching ratio, which depends on VUB squared. And the hadronic matrix element is given by this decay constant. Now these decays are helicity suppressed, and so it is experimentally rather difficult. And then the second class are these semi-leptonic decays. So the B decays into some lighter meson or a charm meson. And then there's another lepton neutrino pair. And here the branching fraction is depending on the transferred in Q squared. And the hadronic matrix element is given by some form factors. And then the nice thing about exclusive decays that is in experiment, they are rather easy to take. So there's a low background. Of course, here in this case, there's a neutrino, which brings additional complications. So the EFD for such decays, they are simply given by the tree-level decay here. And it is just a mixture of lepton of the muon decay and the example I gave you before of a BSCC bar. So now we have only one quark coupling. This brings this VQB. In the EFT, usually we factor out GF and is 4 over square root 2. And the operator is simply the one with a gamma mu P left, gamma mu P left. It has a quark current and a lepton current. Yes. And in principle, for each type of quark that is emitted here and each type of lepton, we should put an index on the C and the Q. But here I will just omit it. I put here also in the EFT just the gauge interactions of QCD and QED to remind you that they are there. And in the standard model, we have only this single operator. As you have seen before, this single operator at tree level is just 1, the Wilson coefficient at the high scale. And it is the same for all the lepton flavors. And this operator has no running under QCD because this quark current is a so-called conserved current. So if you calculate the divergence, it is just canceled by the divergence of the wave functions from these quarks. So the evolution to mu b is trivial. It's just the operator itself. And then you can go beyond leading order in electroweak interaction. So you can dress this with Z bosons or W bosons and photons. This has been done by Alberto Serlin, and it is known as a Serlin correction. So, I'm sorry, the Serlin correction is the matching and the running to the low scale, and it can be summarized in this way. And the Wilson coefficient is now not 1, but it is slightly different from 1. But in phenomenology, people include this correction, usually. So with this EFT, we will go through all the decays. This EFT in the standard model describes all the decays I want to talk, except, you will see it. The FC and C decay I will talk about here a bit. So let's look at the leptonic charge current decay. What you have to calculate is the matrix element of the B to the lepton neutrinos transition. And we usually write this with this bracket notation. And further, we in the bracket notation, we of course we would use include also the gauge interactions of QCD and QD, but we just omit it. And what we mean by this bracket notation is actually an S matrix element. And the S matrix element or the Green's functions, they are given by the path integral. So this notation implicitly means that we treat the in the path integral QCD completely. So of course you cannot do it in perturbation theory, so it must be done non-perturbatively. But this is meant by this notation. And usually QED is, can be treated perturbatively, and so we at lowest order we just neglect photon corrections. So in this case we have just this single operator appearing here. We can pull out the Wilson coefficient and this p-factor out of this matrix element. It's just a scalar. And then since we neglect QED, there's also no interaction between the quark current and the lepton current. So we just replace the lepton current by spinors, and the quark current we parameterize by this decay constant. So this is valid as leading order in QED. And then one can use a equation of motion, one can contract this PB mu, the beam is on momentum, which comes from this definition of this matrix element into the lepton current. Then one uses this. The sum is just the lepton, the sum is just the sum of the lepton momenta, and then each P slash is applied on this spinors, and then we just get the factor M lepton from the lepton spinor. So this is how we evaluated the matrix element. Probably you know this also maybe from examples from the Payan decay. And with this matrix element, we can calculate the branching fraction after doing the phase space integration. And it depends on the lifetime. There's this helicity suppression factor. Then the decay constant squared appears. And then we have this product of GF, VUB, and CVL. And CVL, as I said, it is basically one in the standard model. And nowadays, this decay constant is known rather precisely. So we can calculate the branching fractions, and we can look at the uncertainties in the branching fractions from the decay constant and the lifetime. So as you can see, the decay constant currently poses like a 1.5% uncertainty on FB. So if we would know the branching fraction from measurements with high precision, we could extract VUB with about 1%. I show you also here the rough size of the branching fraction. It ranges from 10 to minus 5 to 10 to minus 12. So this is really experimentally challenging to have a precision measurement. But yes, but at the end ahead for theory, it's the most precise predictions that we can do currently at the 1% level. Now, I also want to talk a bit about this FC and C leptonic decay. And the only difference, more or less, is that now the matching is much more complicated because it proceeds at one loop. So at one loop is these diagrams with only with a Z, not with a photon, sorry. And then with the box, these neutrino, intermediate neutrino. And this is matched on this semi-leptonic operator that I have not shown you before. But this semi-leptonic operator is the only one that will contribute. It is called Q10. It has a gamma mu, gamma 5 in the lepton current. And the effective theory is normalized now again with GF. There's an alpha evo 4 pi because we have these additional couplings here. And then we have to sum over all the internal quarks. So we get VTB, V2T, TQ stuff. And C10 then is itself just a function that depends on the top mass and the W mass ratio. Okay, now similar to this charged current leptonic decay, we can rewrite the matrix element at leading order in QED. And now we get 2 times dml because this other lepton has also mass. And just let me point out why this semileptonic operator Q9 that I talked about at the end of my first lecture does not contribute. It's rather simple to see. It has a gamma mu gamma 5. And now if you contract the PV mu inside here and you use PL and PL bar slash on each side, you get a minus ml from this V-spino. So it just cancels. It would contribute if these two leptons would have different mass. So then it would contribute with the difference of these two leptons. Yes. So that's all I want to say about the matching. So we have this C10 instead of this CVL. And we can calculate the branching fraction. It looks more or less similar. We have lifetime helicity suppression. We have CKM elements. We have the decay constant squared. And we have the Wilson coefficient squared. Yes, and also here, the decay constants are really known precisely from lattice nowadays. And if you look at the uncertainties, then also here the uncertainties from the B sub S decay constant is only 1.1% on the branching fraction. And there's still a 1.1% uncertainty from the top mass itself. So because we don't know the top mass so precisely. And now here it enters in the matching. And then there are other sources like higher order corrections that we have to include in the matching. So the matching is not so trivial like in the charged current decays. Yes, and you can compare that with the first measurements. So the first measurements from, is it a combined average from LHCb, CMS and ATLAS from run 1 and run 2. So the standard model prediction is higher, a bit higher than the measurement. And here we have used a CKM that is based on the inclusive determination of VCV, which is rather high than exclusive ones. So this is another decay that we can really calculate with high precision. And in this decay, we even have some more sensitivity in your physics because in the standard model it's loop suppressed. But then the price that we pay is that experimentally it's very difficult. So the prospects from LHCb are that with 300 inverse femtobound, they might measure the branching fraction with 4% uncertainties. So then if you take these uncertainties and combine them, you can estimate that the uncertainty on VTB, VTS star is about 2.5%. And especially VTS is closely related to VCB, so they're almost equal. And this precision is rather comparable to precisions that we get from tree-level determinations of VCB right now. So it's not about, so here it's really about having a second and class of decays like a FCNC decay that really provides you the precision to determine VCB in an environment where maybe new physics can really contribute more substantially. So this is the main advantage of this. So it's a, it's complementary test. So this is more or less the part on this leptonic decay, so we can calculate them, but experimentally they helicity suppressed. So this is the challenge. So if you have some questions, maybe it's a good point. Otherwise, I will continue with the semileptonic charge current decays. So these are also, I consider the exclusive decays, and now we can have B to U and B to C transitions. And the ones in green, they are B to pseudoscalar, and the experiment and the theory are less problematic. And The others in light blue, they are B2-vector transitions, so the vector mesons are usually not stable final states. So then the theory assumes something like finite width approximation, or on the lattice, they just fix these vector particles to be stable and to prevent them from decay. So they are theoretically not as well under control as these B2 pseudo scalars. And then, of course, each decay mode brings its own experimental problems with it. But usually, E factories are favored because for them it's easier to reconstruct the neutrinos. But also, LHCb is measuring, for example, B2 T star and other semi leptonic decays. And LHCb is currently the only one that might be able to look at B sub S decays and also the baryon decays, lambda B. Okay. Then the interesting observables that can be measured are either differential branching fractions, and from a theoretical point of view, we are more interested in these angular distributions, especially if we are interested in constraining your physics, because they simply offer more observables, as you have seen in the muon decay, where we have the Michel parameters. And since the standard model is lepton flavor universal, people have also started to look at these lepton flavor universal ratios, where one takes ratios of branching fractions with different lepton species. So the advantage in the standard model is there that the CKM element just drops out in the theory prediction. And also the form factor normalization cancels also to a large extent. So we expect these ratios to be rather precisely predictable. And I will talk more about this in the fourth lecture. Now, the matrix element. Again, we start with this matrix element. Now we have in the final state also this meson M. Yes, we just put there this single operator. And we assume leading order QD. So we can factor out the lepton current and contract with the lepton external state to give the spinors. And the rest, we call the hadronic matrix element, and this time it is a form factor because it describes a B going to some other meson. And it depends on the momentum transfer. So it's the B meson momentum minus the momentum of this other meson. And for example, what is then done is one parametrizes these matrix elements depending on the current structure that appears. For example, for the vector current, one decomposes it in Lorentz invariant ways, and there are two form factors appearing here. For B2 pseudoscalar, there is no axial vector current. And if you use this parameterization of this matrix element, you can calculate the differential branching fraction. And it is given by this expression here. So we have a lifetime, there's the CKM element squared, then there are some kinematic factors. And as you can see, the second form factor F0, it comes only with a M lepton over Q squared terms. So in large part of the phase space where Q squared is much larger than ML, it is not really needed. And so in the end, we usually stay with a single form factor, F plus, in this case. Now for tau decays, this second term is also important, so we need to know this other form factor. And if we know the form factors, then we can just extract the CKM matrix element. Now let me show you also the remaining form factor in B2 pseudoscalar. It is given by this tensor current, and there is a single FT form factor. But usually we don't need this tensor form factor in charged current decays because we don't have in the weak Lagrangian operators that have a tensor structure. But just for completeness, there are three B2 pseudoscalar form factors. And then they fulfill the kinematic constraint at Q squared equals zero. What I will talk later about is symmetries between form factors that appear if the large e-quark limit is used. And these symmetries are usually valid up to corrections of order lambda QCD over MB. So if you think of lambda QCD something of below 500 MeV, then it's like a 15 to 10% correction. And there are different sets of form factor relations depending on the transition. So there are the heavy to heavy form factor relations, and then there are the heavy to light form factor relations. So the heavy to light form factor relations I will not talk about here, but yes, they were first worked out also in France. Yes. Mm-hmm. And then one can, for heavy to light, there are two regimes. There are form factor relations that are simply valid in the MB to infinity limit. And then there are these large recoil limit relations that in addition require that the light recoiling meson is very energetic. So then the symmetries are even further enhanced. So just let me show you also beta vector form factor definitions. In this case, there are more form factors. So there's a vector form factor V from this vector current. There are axial vector and scalar form factors, A1, A2, and A0. And there are also tensor form factors, but those do not contribute in charge current decays. And also in the kinematical limit Q squared to zero, there are some constraints for these form factors. All right. So if we know the form factors, we can calculate everything. Now, yes, I'm sorry. I just want to mention also lambda B to lambda C form factors. There are vector form factors, axial vector form factors, and also tensor form factors. And they are also partially under investigation. So how are these form factors determined currently? We have more or less two methods, apart from models, of course. And the first method I want to discuss about is the lattice QCD. So this is a method that does numerical evaluations on a discretized finite space-time continuum. And it is a more or less a first principle method, in particular for B to pseudoscalar transitions. But I guess in the future, there will be also B to vector form factors. This method works really nice at high Q squared when the recoiling meson is very slow. So the B sits in the rest frame, then it decays. The leptons are very fast and the final recoiling meson, it just stays there. And then lattice works very well. So in B to U transitions, it's about this endpoint region here. And in B to D's and B to D star, it's more here, where lattice provides predictions. And nowadays, the uncertainties are already below 10% for B to pseudoscalar. And the second method is the method of light cone sum rules. And this works well at a low Q squared, so at large recoil, when the meson recoils strongly against the B meson and the leptons stay at rest more or less where the B meson was before. And there are two setups currently in the literature. So there are setups which involve light meson, light cone distribution amplitudes that are needed to know to be as an input. And there's a second method that uses B meson light cone distribution amplitudes as an input. So I think Eva worked on the first part, and then there are people in the literature who use the second one. At the second one, the one advantage is, for example, that one can treat all the meson systems more or less with the same input, because one does not need to know about the light mesons anything. But apart from that, these light cone sum rules, they consider a hadronic correlation functions, and they calculate it in two ways. So in the first, they use unitarity by inserting a complete set of states and then a dispersive representation to single out the form factor. And then the second method of calculating this hadronic correlation functions uses a light cone OPE at some value of Q squared where perturbation theory is applicable, so it's far away from some resonances. And then by matching both results, so this involves an assumption about quark-hadron duality also, they can obtain a sum rule for this form factor that appears in this dispersive representation. Okay, so there's some assumptions in this second approach, and the uncertainties are also rather large. Okay, so let us have a look on V2 pseudoscalar form factors from the lattice. So you can see B2 pi form factor, F plus and F naught, and B2D form factor, also F plus and F naught. And the green points are points that have been calculated by the lattice. And then these curves, the bands, are obtained by fitting a parametrization to these points. And later I will try to explain you why these so-called Z parameterizations are interesting here. So here they use a special form which is called the BCL parameterization with three terms in this sum. So there are some coefficients A that are fitted, and this variable Z is just a mapping of the Q squared into a unit disk. So it's a conformal transformation to the unit disk of Q squared. And later you will see why this is useful. But here it's just see it as a parametrization to do an extrapolation and in this variable Z beyond the points where lattice has calculated the form factor. And you can see that the results have some uncertainty and so on. And they included also the constraint that these two form factors at Q squared equals zero are the same. Now, you can use these form factors and fit from the data, for example, VUB or VCB, and simultaneously fit also these nuisance parameters A and see how they improve. And this is also done and shown here. Now you see a lot of purple and blue points. They come from Babar and Bell analysis at different values of Q squared. And you see how the uncertainties on these form factors shrink, as you would expect, because you include more information. Okay, so this is often done, that one uses some form factor from some calculation within this factor parametrization in Z expansion, and then one fits them to the data. Okay, now for beta vector form factors, the theory is not so solid. And in lattice, they have to assume that the vector is stable, so they somehow prevent it from decaying by choosing some special kinematics. And the similar issues are there for light cone sum rules. So there are some assumptions involved here. But and then from the lattice, we have currently only a prediction of this form factor A1. At very large Q squared, at the maximal Q squared, so at zero recoil of the D star. And the reason for that is usually that form factor symmetries have been used in the past. And as you will see later, if I manage in this lecture, otherwise in the next one, there is symmetries are so strong that they even kind of fix the form factor at high Q, at this zero recoil point, to leading order in lambda over MB. So from the lattice, you can see the blue point. This is the result here. And then from light cone sum rules, they have calculated them even at negative Q squared, which seems favorable for achieving numerical stabilities in these sum rules, you have these black points here. And then there's an old calculation, which is this red point. This is another Lightcon sum rule calculation. And now the sum rules by themselves, they constrain the form factor not so well, especially in the physical region. But combining it with the lattice, you get some first result that you can use in phenomenological applications. So here we do not know so much from first principle calculations. But as you will see later on, with this additional method and these form factor relations, people have managed to be much more precise. Okay. So this brings me, yes, if you have questions before I go to the Z expansions. All right. Then, yes, I've mentioned the Z expansion, and there we've just taken it as a convenient parameterization, but here I want you to understand why they are so convenient. And if you're really interested, there's also a textbook by Irina El Caprini, who, yes, gives a really complete presentation of the problems, of the whole problem. So, for the moment, I had introduced the form factors as a transition of a B to some meson state via some current. And now in standard model, this current is just gamma mu P left. But by crossing symmetry, the annihilation or the production of a B and an M from the vacuum or to the vacuum is given by the same function, just at some other place in the Q squared plane. So we can, the same function appears in both. So if you manage to learn something about this one, we can infer something about this one. Now, where these things enter, we will see in a minute. So let us start from a two-point correlation function that is given here. It's a time-ordered product of these currents that appear here between the vacuum. And usually this can be written as a longitudinal term and a transverse term. And it has been shown that in QCD, these things fulfill a they are analytic, so they can be written in with the help of a dispersion relation. So if you just for simplicity assume that n equals zero, then the function itself at some point q squared is given by the integral over the real axis, the positive real axis, if we know the imaginary part of this function. And yes, usually you have to use some, maybe you close your contours somehow, and if this function does not fall off sufficiently fast, you can use this subtraction method by subtracting the function at some point, and then it you can close the contour and the infinity does not contribute in these things. So this is meant by this subtraction prescription. So this PA fulfills this dispersion relation, can be presented in this way. So, if we know the imaginary part, we can calculate it at some value of q squared, or the other way around, if we know it at some value of q squared, maybe we can learn something about the imaginary part. And in fact, this chi, so the subtracted function, it can be calculated perturbatively if the q squared is such that it is far away from places in the phase space where this current can create resonances. So it should be far away from the threshold of where this B to M can be produced, for example. And for B to D or for B to D star, it is sufficient to go to Q squared equals zero. And then there's this so-called standard OPE, where this function can be calculated in terms of local operators of rising dimension with some Wilson coefficients. So these operators have nothing to do with the operators I talked about in the weak effective theory. So they are different operators. And yes, so we can calculate these functions with an OPE at some value of Q squared. So we know the left-hand side in this relation. Now we still don't know how this is related to these matrix elements here. And let us insert a complete set of on-shell states into this time-ordered product, which is a complete means unitarity, using unitarity. And then we can use a trick where we shift this argument of this first current from x to zero, which can be achieved by just multiplying by e to di px, where p is the momentum operator. And this momentum operator then we act to the left and the other to the right and pull out the momentum of this state. So we get from the left, we get zero. From the right, we get the momentum of this intermediate state, e to the minus I pn. And if we combine it with this and do the Fourier transform, we simply obtain this delta function here. And now we are already quite close to what we are looking actually for. Yes, we're looking for this. So if we choose the mu to be equals nu, then on the right hand side we obtain a positive expression. And if we then, in this sum over all the intermediate states, if you just keep the lowest one, which would be the B plus M production state, then this sum must be larger than this sum. So the imaginary part of P mu mu is larger than this integral. And you can recognize that now the first term here, where we keep only the B to M state, is simply the matrix element we were looking for. So in the imaginary part, we have this form factor, some value of Q squared that corresponds to B plus M production. So we can now use that this imaginary part is given by this dispersion relation. And so we just plug it in into the dispersion relation. That's how it ends up here in the numerator. And then we bring the chi on the other side, on this side. So we have one on this side. And this is a bound on the form factor in some region of Q squared. And as you have noted, in the dispersion relation, the integral started with zero. But here we have replaced it by the momentum of the B plus M state, because the phase space integral, it contains some theta function with the threshold of this state. So in this way, you can see we have derived the bound on the form factor in some region of the Q squared plane. So let me give you some intermediate part, where we now try to express the form factors not in Q squared, but we map the Q squared plane to the unit disk. And let us see how this works. So if we have the Q squared plane, we have the lepton threshold, we have the maximum Q squared, which is MB minus MM squared. I call it here T minus. And then at some point, we have the threshold where we can produce B to M state at T plus. And by mapping it with this expression, where T zero is some arbitrary place here in the semi-leptonic region, that we can choose freely. What will happen with this transformation is that the semi-leptonic region will end up around zero. This T0 will be exactly mapped to Z equals zero. And then this, if we go along the real axis above the real axis, starting from T plus, this contour will be mapped on the unit circle, upper unit circle, and the lower contour on the lower unit circle. And T plus will be at minus one, and the one will be infinity. So you can choose the T0 such that the semi-leptonic region is just around here. And if you look at the physical systems and you calculate, for example, where this region ends up, you will find that it ends up at values that are very small for B to D, yes? So C is very small. And if you think of the form factor being an analytic function, then it's kind of natural to expand it in Z. For the B to pi, it's still small. So this is the idea behind this transformation. Now, the unitarity bound in this new variable, it will take this form. Now, before we had the integral over such a contour here, now we integrate over the whole unit circle. Oops, sorry. The pointer is getting crazy. So, and there's a function that we call outer function, and is related to this phase space and this chi. So let me see. If you remember, the chi is here and there's some phase space function that comes from here. And then what can happen in reality is that you can have some stable resonances, for example, like a B to C. And these resonances, I'm sorry, these resonances, they sit below T plus and above T minus here. So there can be these additional poles here. And these poles can be removed just by putting in some Blaschke factor that takes care of that, such that the product BZ, B times F, is still an analytic function, has no poles. So the unitarity bounds in the unit disk looks like this now. So if we now make an ansatz and expand the form factor in such a way, in a series in Z, then in the semi-leptonic region of interest, the Z is always small. And then there are these factors, some arbitrary coefficients that we don't know yet. But if we plug this ansatz into the unitarity bound down here, the phi and the B, they will cancel. And then actually we get a bound on the sum of all these squares of the coefficients. So each coefficient by itself must be smaller than one. So this is a really strong constraint. So we can have hope that if we truncate this sum after sum, first terms, that it describes the form factor very well. So this is all the ideas behind this form factor parameterizations. And it's a, yes, it's a powerful and model independent method. And there are different parameterizations of this type in use. So there's one called BGL. It goes back to Boyd, Greenstein, and Leavitt. And they simply use this form and they use these outer functions as they get them from the phase space integrations of the involved decays. And the unitarity bound on these coefficients really takes this special form. And there's another one that I've shown you before, and that is used usually by FLAG as for the flavor lattice flavor averaging group, and also by many lattice groups that provide parameterizations of their form factor results. And it goes back to Borelli, Caprini, and Lelouch. And here, these outer functions, they are replaced by some simple poles that you expect that these form factors should have. And the price to pay for that is that the unitarity bounds on these coefficients A, they do not take this simple form, but they take a more complicated form. But one can still work out these coefficients and see that the series does not become ill-behaved or something, that these coefficients get too large. So with this, I would like to conclude this section on the C expansion. You will see it often in the literature, so I hope it helps you a bit to have an idea what it means. It is, in the easiest case, it's just a convenient form factor parameterization. But if you combine it with unitarity and dispersion relations, you can derive a very powerful constraint that really gives strong arguments why such a series can be truncated after a few terms. So, if you have questions, maybe that's a possibility for you to ask. So if you have questions, you can also ask Eva. She worked on that.
I have a comment, actually. Just that you are stressing the constraint that you get from the unitarity bound, but in the end, the constraint is not really very strong or helpful, depending on which channel you're using it for. For the beta C decays, it's much more useful than for the beta light Meson decays.
Okay, yes. Yeah, you have worked on this. So maybe it's more for, so in any case, it's a formal proof that these AK are small. So there's, depending on which parameterization you use. So yes, it's a justification why we can truncate these expansions. If you have other information on the form factor from lattice or some light cone sum rules, that are already so stringent that you don't need this unitarity bound, this is probably a different question. I think this is what you're referring to.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the past, people did not have information from lattice and light cone sum rules. And these methods, they come from the 90s, where there was basically nothing known about the form factors. Okay, so then, yes, let me try to continue with the last part. So I'm not sure if I finish it, but let's see. Now, the last part is about having to have form factors and the constraints that we can obtain on these from the large MB limit. So this is often done within the heavy quark effect theory. So you can find textbook on this from Anish Manu and Mark Weiss. But there are also many, many lectures. So I just give these two here. So what is considered in heavy quark effective theory is a bound state of a single heavy quark with some light quark. And by heavy, we mean that the light quarks is of light order lambda QCD. And the heavy quark mass is much larger than that. So in practice, we think about MB or charm system. And then we always think to be in the rest frame of the B meson or close to it. So now then the interaction of the light quarks and gluon with this heavy quark can be described with this heavy quark effective theory that I'm trying to explain here in the following. And yes, often these light quarks and gluons, they're called the brown muck that flies around the heavy quark. Now, if you think of the heavy quark velocity, this scales with the heavy quark mass. The momentum scales with the heavy quark mass. And now the light degrees of freedom, if they change this, their contribution to this heavy quark momentum, delta p mu, it is of order lambda QCD. So in the heavy quark limit, this goes to zero, which means that the heavy quark is just there with constant velocity. And if you're really in the best frame, then it is just here. The V is just, it has just an entry one at the temporal component, and the spatial component is just zero. Now, the consequence of this is that all heavy quarks look alike. So it doesn't matter if there is a B quark or a chunk quarks. For the light degrees of freedom, they all look the same. And so there must be some heavy quark flavor symmetry. And it is broken by effects that depend on the heavy quark mass themselves. So. And in the rest frame, this heavy quark, it just acts as a static color charge. And so there are no spin interactions at this order. And these heavy quark spin symmetries, they are first broken at subleading order in 1 over the heavy quark mass by chromomagnetic interactions. And the effective theory can be organized in a series where the higher order terms are suppressed by heavy quark mass. And only the first term has this spin flavor symmetry. All right. So what is usually done is that the heavy quark field, the QCD field, is split. So first, the large frequency modes are decoupled, factored out by this exponential, and then it is split in 2 fields. And by definition, this first field and the second also, they fulfill this equations of motion, projections. Now, if we insert this decomposition in the QCD Lagrangian, then we get these exponentials. We let the covariant derivative act on the exponential. We get this term MQV slash down here, and we can combine them here in this way, and we can multiply them all out. So there's this small h and the capital H field. And now we use the equation of motion to eliminate the one with the capital H field. And what we rest with is the QCD Lagrangian rewritten in this way. So it has this first term, and then the second term that has this non-local behavior because it contains this inverse derivative. And since we have factored out this large frequency fluctuations of the field, whenever this derivative acts on this field, in position space, it just will pull out some residual momentum that scales with lambda QCD. Yes? So this will be smaller than this heavy quark mass. So what we do in practice is to expand this term here in powers of 1 over mq. This is shown here. So the leading term is just 1 over 2 mq, and then we have higher power terms. And now they're again local after this expansion, because the derivative is now in the numerator. All right, so with this, we can write down the expansion and restricting to the first and the second term, it looks like that. And then the second term can be expanded in this way with these 2 terms. And the first one is called kinetic energy, and the second one is the magnetic moment. And this magnetic moment interaction, it breaks the heavy quark spin and flavor symmetry. And the kinetic energy, it breaks the flavor symmetry. Both of them break because they are proportional to the quark mass, the heavy quark mass. So they will be different for different heavy quarks. This is what's simply meant by that. Now, there's something that is called reparametrization invariance. And these invariance implies transformation of V, of this velocity V. We could have chosen a slightly different V and written down the same Lagrangian. And the parametrization invariance is when this Lagrangian is invariant under such transformations. And what follows from such a reparametrization and the requirement of invariance is that this first term and the second term, they are related with each other. And from this follows that this kinetic energy is not renormalized to all orders in alpha s. So remember, we have derived this Lagrangian at tree level, but now with this reparametrization invariance, we can show that there's this term is not changed by alpha s corrections in the matching. On the other hand, this second term, the magnetic moment term, it's not protected by that, such corrections, as such a parametrization invariance. So here we have a Wilson coefficient, and in the matching it can get higher order alpha s corrections. Now, when it comes to normalization of hadron states, in QCD we usually normalize them to the energy, but in HQT it's preferable to move out some factor of the quark mass here or the heavy hadron mass. So people usually use this normalization with V0. And so these two states, the QCD and the heavy HQT states, they are related by this factor of square root up to higher order corrections. Okay. So in what follows, I will use instead of Q squared this rescale W, it's just a recoil of this D meson or D star meson. It's given by this PB dot PD. But since both are considered as heavy, we can factor out the B and the B D star mass. So we have a V and a V prime. So it's just a scalar product of V, V prime. And it's given by this expression. So at the zero recoil, when the D star is at rest, it is one. And then if Q squared goes to zero, it goes up to 1.6. And for this discussion, it is also more convenient to introduce this parameterization of form factors of these matrix elements. B to pseudoscalar for the vector, and B to D star for the vector and axial vector currents. So we have here two form factors, and here we have four. And in heavy quark effective theory, we would like to rewrite this form for these matrix elements to learn something about them. And there is a technique of calculating these matrix elements with operator from the operator of these operators with the help of some hadronic field. And this exploits the heavy quark symmetry. So the ground state duplet of the pseudoscalar and the vector spin one, the pseudoscalar and the vector, they form a ground state duplet under this heavy quark symmetries. So we can write some meson fields in terms of this V and pseudoscalar in this form. And they transform under heavy quark symmetry in this way, the same way as a quark field, just that they are objects which are B spinors. So they are 4x4 matrices. And what one does then is one can argue that we can replace the quark currents by some trace that involves this hadronic fields. In between, there's the same current structure. And then there's an additional matrix X that takes care of the dynamics of the light fields. So this is very abstract. So, and what we know is that the light degrees of freedom can have only a spin 1/2, so that we either end up with a because the heavy quark has spin 1/2, the light degrees have either plus or minus spin 1/2. So we end up either with a pseudoscalar or with a vector. Yes? So this X can be only parameterized in terms of a 4x4 matrix, and there are no Lorentz spinors involved. And it can depend only on the initial and the final velocities. So it is written in this way. Now, if one uses the, if one now calculates this trace, one can use this relations that hold for these heavy fields, that they are project V slash applied on these fields is the field itself, and V slash is one. One can pull out here V slash or V prime slash factors and then act on these, and we see that this X is just a scalar function, and it is called minus Xi, and this Xi is known as the Iskovitz function. So this is a very technical in here, and I did not explain very well the foundations, but this is what happens in the calculation. And then one can use this trace. One uses just, if one has a pseudoscalar, one puts here this 1 plus V slash 1 half, the gamma 5 here. The same with this, for example. If one calculates B to D transition, for example, one puts the gamma 5 here with this V prime. And then for this heavy field, one puts the gamma 5 also with a V. And then one just calculates the trace and gets the matrix element of this current. Okay, and as we see now, they are all proportional to the same function, psi. Now, if one does that, one arrives at this relation that all these form factors are proportional to the same psi, and these two form factors are zero. And these are the form factor relations for heavy-to-heavy form factors at the leading power. Now, one can go even a step further, and try to calculate this Iskovitz function at zero recoil when W goes to one. And for this, it is easiest to consider the current of B bar B between two heavy B meson states. So when this goes to one, it's at zero recoil. So this is basically the B number current in QCD. And it is given by 2 times the B meson momentum. If you go and rewrite this in terms of HQT meson states, we get this factor in B. And then if we use the parameterization of this matrix element, there's only this H plus term with V plus V plus V, V. So there was another term with H minus with V minus V that vanishes. And you see from this that the Xi at at zero recoil is really one. So we can even determine the normalization. So at zero recoil, all these form factors are one. So this is a very strong constraint up to lambda over B corrections. And these form factor relations, they're even protected at order one of MQ. So the corrections come only in at order one of MQ squared. And this is known as Luke's theorem. And of course, this current that appears in these form factors, they receive some QCD corrections. So if we include this matching, which is known up to 2 loops, then the Xi from one gets a correction factor eta A from alpha S corrections. That's about 4% destructive. I'm sorry. And then there are some 1 over m q squared corrections to this relation. So you see, heavy quark effective theory allows you to derive these very strong constraints on these many form factors that enter B to D and B to D star. And one can even extend this to the form factors of a B star to a D star or B star to D and so on. And now on the last slide, I would just introduce you to another form factor parameterization that is often used, which is the Caprini-Lelouch-Neubert form factor parameterization. So this parameterization combines all these pin parity channels that are present here, and it includes also BC poles in unitarity bounds on these form factors. And then on top, it exploits also the symmetry relations from HQT. So it includes alpha S corrections, and then it includes also the 1 over Q squared corrections. And out of that, it builds a Z expansion with all these constraints up to order 3. So there are, for a single form factor, B2D, for example, there are 3 parameters. But what they find is that the unitary bounds are so strong that the rho 1 and C1 are strongly correlated, and the D1 is quasi-fixed. So in the end, they say, propose a parameterization with a single parameter rho 1, which is not necessary to use, necessarily the one they recommend to use, but that's what they find. And further, all other form factors that appear there, they can express also in terms of this Z expansion, or V minus 1 here, where all these coefficients A, B, C, D are calculated within HQT. So these are either alpha S corrections or the one over MQ squared corrections. And yes, the CNL parameterization has been used in the past very often in experiments, and it seems often the full parameterization has not been used. So only one parameter has been used in the fit, like this rho 1 squared. And this parameterization has then been used to extract the form factor times VCB at 0 recoil point. Yes, and maybe, yeah, the criticism I understand from the literature is that maybe they should not have done it in this restrictive way, but maybe should have included also the other C1 and D1, and maybe also included the uncertainties on these coefficients A, B, C, D. So this is to give you an idea what this CNL parameterization is about. So this is all I wanted to talk about in this lecture. Thank you.